much, Erica. And thank you everybody for staying, you know, so many things have been already said, and it's been, you know, really thought-provoking. I wonder whether I still have something to catch your attention or provoke some more thinking. Now, this research, I'm going to talk about a research which is part of a collaborative research that I'm doing with some animal scientists, part of this large European project that Erica was mentioning, where Emma and Henry were already also participating, that in the last 10 years, I mean, has been trying to produce a standard for animal welfare for the European Union, and has been investigating different ways of assessing and measuring animal welfare. And there has been quite lots of discussion around, you know, how to define and how to measure animal welfare. So that's exactly where I want to start from today. And first of all, I want to thank you, Carolina, for providing some of the inspiration of ideas about different ways of enacting animal welfare. Now, this is an idea about animal welfare, a powerful enactment, I think, that comes from design. Ford's proposal involves surgically removing the animal's cerebral cortex but maintaining the lower brain function so the body can continue to grow without the capacity to sense the environment. The bird is arguably not in a state of suffering, which is a far cry from current farming practices. The other effect is that the birds can be packed into a much more horizontal space in just about any type of building, upping the productivity from one chicken for 10 cubic feet to nearly 4 chickens in the same area. The animal is fed water and nutrients through a tube and its esophagus, and another tube removes the waste. The body is then strapped into a frame which can stack the bodies vertically. The design is vastly different from what we ever seen outside the movie The Matrix, a fact that Ford alludes to. The similarities are patent, although in The Matrix, the dominant species were kind enough to provide the subspecies with an alternate reality, which was far better than their real post-apocalyptic world. This was a lovely gesture by the machines. But the chickens in this system will not be provided with such a luxurious appendage to an already elaborate system, especially in this age of austerity. This is a powerful enactment, I think, of animal welfare in the form of cruelty-free. It's a sort of futuristic design, not so much futuristic, is available, is doable. But somehow it seems to speak to an idea of animal welfare which is actually based on the freedom from hunger, freedom from discomfort, freedom from pain, freedom from fear and distress, and is very much, you know, speaking to an idea of animal welfare which is only concerned with cruelty and pain. Even though probably the advocate of these ideas, the fight freedom, they had a much more richer ideas, but it was expressed in this kind of prioritizing suffering and pain as the main issues when it comes to animal welfare. But how is animal welfare enacted in food products? Is it what is currently perceived as animal welfare, these ideas of cruelty-free? Well, we see that, especially in the UK in current times, we have, you know, the advocates of another ideas, another enactment of animal welfare, celebrity chefs and other, you know, powerful NGOs. They propose very, very different ideas. Some of these I've already discussed it in the paper that Emma this morning was mentioning and Erica was mentioning as well. I'll give you just a snapshot of this, but the volume is not working.
Yeah, is the volume working? You plugged in the mic.
I did plug in the mic.
put in the right.
Yeah. Well, we do without. We do without. It doesn't work. Okay, well, it doesn't matter, you know, but the idea is that, you know, there is a very different, there is a very different enactment of what animal welfare might be, which is advocated by different, which is circulated in the public and is advocated by different spokesperson, which actually speaks about a different quality of life of animals, and is not, and is much more than not suffering or cruelty-free, and is engaging with a much more messier sets of ideas that they go under what I call the four categories of animals' happiness, which is very messy, very complicated, difficult to investigate. Now, some of you might have been a couple of weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, to a conference in London, Cosmopolitan Animals, where Donna Haraway has been suggesting, you know, to look at string figures, what she calls string figures, or little stories, stories about those stories about science investigations, those stories that make histories. And she's been looking at, she's been proposing, you know, to look at string figures like, you know, those stories that propose and enact patterns for participants to inhabit a vulnerable world with access to multiple species suffering. She proposes to look at these figures as the possibility of partial recuperation, not a dream of restoration or reconciliation, but the possibility of partial recuperation as a search for finding something that works, something beautiful that was not there before. Attachment to attachment, digit to digit, year to year, feather to feather, to ask the question, what is like to write and think and act in a time of extinction and extermination, with Deborah Bird Rose. Stories of scientific practices that redo ways of living and dying in multi-species present and future entanglements that Donna Haraway has called staying with the trouble. And it's something that, and in this kind of vein, in this kind of spirit, I want to tell a story of one of these practices, not as a way of reconciliation, not serving, you know, not for recuperation, but just as a very, very modest way of intervening in something. These stories of scientific practices question some of the features of contemporary knowledge production, and then I think are interesting in bringing about new questions. Now, at this point, I was supposed to show a short video, and I don't know how to do that, but it's going to be silent. It's going to be a silent film. Yeah. No, is there one?
Yeah. Can you come out of your lap? They can show it in a separate file. Maybe that I'll go and see if I can poke things.
Well, I can do without the microphone, maybe. I can do without
try
the microphone.
Try it with, and then let's just see.
And see if it works.
Which has got
Are you? Okay. Well, the first one, well, you see it as a silent, as a silent movie. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean much. Well, the first stories that I want to sell, that I want to say is an ethnography, Well, we don't see much now.
Come out of full screen, so click escape or something to come out of the full screen. And see if you can get there.
Was it work? Could you see it before?
No.
Somebody who knows how to do this, go down and help Mara.
Forget about it. There was supposed to be a movie, but he's not going to be here.
He shouldn't even play it.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Is that there's images? Is it on a DVD or?
Yeah. It's on a DVD. It was working previously. We tried with the technician, but doesn't seem to work now. But basically, the first story is about Sweetgrass. Sweetgrass is an ethnographic work that he was done by Lisa Barbash and Lucien Castin Taylor. And in the spring of 2001, living in Colorado, these two authors heard about a family of Norwegian-American sheep herders in Montana, who were the last to be trailing the flock of sheep, long distances, about 150 miles, all on hoof, up to the mountains for summer pasture. They visited them that April during lambing and were so taken with the magnitude of their life that they ended up working with them. It took them about 5 weeks to drive their sheep from the ranch to the basin at 11 feet where they passed the summer. And Sweetgrass is a documentary with the pitch, the end of a defining chapter in the history of American West, the dying world of herders as they struggle to make a living in an era incredibly inimical to their interest. Set in a landscape of remarkable beauty that I'm so sorry you won't be able to see it, and the scale almost unimaginable to Europeans, the film portrays a world colored by an intense propinquity between nature and culture. One that has been integral to the fabric of human existence through history, but almost unimaginable for the urban masses today. The sheep have been taken, after the summer, the sheep have been taken to the market. The herders now work as hired hands. And the film Sweetgrass is finished, completed, and is a modest record of a world that is no more. Spending the summer, for the two ethnographers was an experience that they said they will never forget. And it was also a way of revealing a world in which nature and culture, animals and humans, vulnerability and violence were all intimately meshed. Now, we move from, the Montana, which unfortunately you haven't seen, to another farm. A very different space. This is a farm where I spent 6 weeks in Clermont-Ferrand in France. It's an IRRA research center that hosts more than 700 animal scientists and some 300 cows and about 200 sheep in two experimental settings. I joined the animal behavior team, just less than 20 scientists and PhD students who are doing research on animal emotion. I participated to one of their experiments on stress and fear on sheep. Their assumption or their research concerns is that we know very little about animals' emotion. The starting point is that emotion are basic processes on which more prolonged states develop. Stress or welfare. Animal welfare refers to pioneer stress studies, and this has to do with the origin of animal welfare science, and research on animal welfare are generally been limited to indicators of stress and hasn't linked these indicators to the possible emotional states. What emotion the various animal species can feel remain unclear in the signs, and the existence of emotional states common to both humans and other animals is not easily accepted in the scientific community. And that's exactly where their research is located, in this contest and in these very contested issues, whether emotions which are experienced by humans can be researched or very much thought as a proper topic for research in animal science. The problem that they wanted to address was the stress experienced by the sheep who were reintroduced into natural environment after being kept in an indoor system for larger part of their life. Actually, the very problem that they were addressing was how to make a sheep to become a good mother while living outdoor. The breed of sheep in the experimental farm had been selected for high productivity. Each sheep is giving birth to twins and very often to triplets, but they are kept indoor all the time so they can feed the lambs if the mother has not enough milk. When they try to reintroduce them outdoors, it turned out that these sheep are very fearful, and if they hear a car or a plane, they run away and they leave behind the lambs. If they don't find the lambs within a very short period of time, they seem to forget about them and the lambs die. Given that cars and other sources of noise are quite frequent, the sheep living outdoors experience more stress than the ones living indoors. Actually, if they're given a chance, they don't go outdoors. The experiment was about to identify what are the events that might induce fear in sheep and what are the techniques to make them to overcome the fear or being able to cope with the fear-inducing event, so that they can live outdoor without stress and they can become good mothers. The experiment consists in exposing the sheep to an extended period of time to a noise or a bright color. They might induce fear and to offer them some food as a reward. After a period of training that lasts several weeks, the sheep learn that the noise and the bright color is not a sign of danger, but actually something that they can accustom to, and something pleasurable might be associated with it, food. In order to do the experiment, 48 sheep were trained for several weeks, and they enter in pairs a small experimental theater where a small device was prepared to produce a noise, and the window would open and the bright flag would appear. So these are the sheep in the experimental site pen, waiting to do the experiment. Some of them are puzzled, interest. And this is the experimental site. As you can see, it's very low tech. It's constructed inside the farm. So it's all very, you know, very simple. In the theater, there was a bucket with some wheat. The sheep were invited to go into the theater in pair. At the beginning, they were wearing a heartbeat belt, a monitoring device that would record the heartbeat, and one of the technicians would take blood sample and saliva samples to check the level of cortisol. After the initial phase of observation and sample taking, the scientists were able to link the level of stress indicated by the level of cortisol in the blood and the saliva, as well as by the speed of the heartbeat, and to link it to the facial expression of the sheep, more precisely to the posture of the ears. And they didn't need to record all the physiological measure anymore, but they were able to judge the level of fear or stress by looking at just at the ear posture. The training is repeated every day. It takes about 3 hours for the entire flock of 48 sheep, and it goes on for about 2 or 3 months. So this is about the other equipment that are present. You know, the simple bucket with some wheat. This is the kind of device for producing noise or color, and here again, you're going to have a silent. I'm going to leave it like that because if I make
it. Do you want to unplug the microphone and put it on just so we can hear your computer? So at least there is. I have got a technician on his way, so we can have a DVD at the end. So. There you go.
So this is part of the training, and what they say while they are there is that they are explaining to me why they do the training always in pairs. Because sheep, they don't like to be isolated from the group. It's already traumatic to take them away and channeling them to the theater. So they organize all these different combination of animals where they put together always a dominant sheep with a less dominant one, and they see whether the learning process is actually facilitated or hampered by the combination of different kind of animals. But it's also a way of reducing the stress of actually performing the training. And this is, you know, this is part of the training because before they can actually expose the sheep to the flag or to a noise, they need to become familiar with this environment. They need to know that they are going to find some food, and it's something that they do routinely. And after the experiment, they can actually be reunited with the rest of the herd. The other interesting part of that we can't hear about this is the sort of looking after the sheep while they are moving from one space to another one. One of the words that is always, Alessandra, the PhD researcher, is always says, reminding the sheep, doucement, move slowly, don't hurt yourself, make sure that nothing is going wrong when they are performing. You know, these kind of training. Yeah. Okay. Well, we can go. I think we can go on. After, as I said, after the training, they actually perform the real experiment, and then there is lots of measure taking. They look at behavioral responses, and they take videos of the ear posture, and the video is actually analyzed through a specific software. But they also take cortisol level, catecholamine level, immune system parameters, cardiac responses, growth parameters. And so it's a long process and long investment of recording, monitoring, using lots of devices, putting everything together. And it takes a long time and care. And this is repeated with different groups of animals in different conditions and different ages. And everything is recorded carefully with different pairs. But part of the research is also looking after the environment in which you do the research. And lots of effort is put in keeping clean all the pens, you know, working with the carers, making sure that, as I said, that the the environment is clean and fine, and the sheep are okay. They're not actually, they're not affected by the stress. So after every training session, there is a kind of debriefing with the sheep, and a session of, you know, checking with them if they are okay. I couldn't resist to join Alessandra in this part. Okay, this is a simple story, but it's also a set of events and a set of practices that has a great deal to do with animals. I'll come to the animal character of the animal practices shortly. But first I want to say something about practices. So what is a practice? Well, this is a term which is widely used in STS or in sociology in different ways. Here, it means that I've been looking at what scientists actually do in practice, not only what they write in papers. The idea was that the scientific method is often idealized in conventional philosophy and methodology, and that again, in practice, science in the laboratories or in the vet surgery or in the, you know, experiment theater is different, more complex, messier than the idealized description of it that typically turn up in textbook or in the writing of many philosophers. And if you're able to do this, then in turn out to be fairly easy to show that in practice, laboratory life is a set of compromises and negotiation with budget, deadline, colleagues, and more or less undisciplined experimental apparatuses and materials. And the sheep very often, rebel and they don't collaborate. It isn't necessarily a disastrous mess because it goes on everywhere and it usually works. But it certainly looks messy from the point of view of a sort of idealized accounts of science. Therefore, I think it's important to attend to the experimental farms and settings, to the video cameras, the stress-inducing event, the stress relief rewards, heartbeat monitor belt, blood sample, saliva sample, cortisol measure, computers, PhD students, technician, animal carers, expert knowledge, and I could go on and on, which is the vast array of people and artifacts that constitute the scientific practice of making the animal and its emotion to emerge. The approach I adopt here offers a particular toolkit for thinking about the character of this practice. First of all, it suggests to attend to the diversity, heterogeneity of practice, then to its character as a set of relation, to the way in which it extends beyond the site, and to do all this with a very detailed and specific manner. So diversity and heterogeneity draws attention to the different kinds of qualities of elements that are caught up and help to compose a practice. These elements are heterogeneous, they are different in kind. Look at what was happening at the experimental farm. First, of course, there were people. The team decided on the research protocol. Alessandra, the PhD student, organizing the experiment. Dominique, the animal carer, working with Alessandra and handling the sheep. Steve in the physiology lab, processing the blood sample and calculating the level of cortisol for each pair of sheep and for each event. And Luke, the technician, looking at facial expression and the ear posture using the specific software of the sheep and using and analyzing the behavior of the sheep. And the chief scientist, Alain and Isabel, putting together this data and making a correlation between a certain level of cortisol in blood and saliva and a certain facial expression, ear posture. Another element of sheep behavior. Second, there were animals. Four small groups of 12 sheep each, in which these groups, and within these groups, there were the brave and the shy sheep. Third, there were technologies and devices, including video recording cameras, animal feed, the experimental theater, the fleck, the noise, the bucket, the TV monitor. And fourth, there were building and special arrangements, barns, pens, barriers, the labs and the fields. Fifth, there were documents, legal forms, checklists, label for blood samples, label for videotapes, valuation documents, animal welfare protocol, safety protocol, and a lot more. And one can go on and add into the list. The materials caught up in the practice are heterogeneous, and this diversity is important and deserves attention. So many things can go wrong. As part of this, it foregrounds material, for instance, buildings, paperwork, and animal behavior, that are not always given such a prominent position in sociological account of practice. All of these play their part in how the action unfolds, and we need to trace the way in which all of them interact. and constitute what we call the emotion or the animal, the results. And this is the key to the second point, relationality. Every component in a practice plays its role, animate or inanimate, human, animal, and otherwise. So for instance, Dominique needed to separate and hold the couple of sheep that each time were called by Alessandro to do the experiment. Alessandro needed to decide how to pair the sheep for each moment of the experiment. Then still Alessandro needed to refill the bouquet with some wheat for the following couple of sheep. Here we see a form of bodily choreography involving two people and several animals. In other moments of the practice, devices are involved too. For instance, the behavior of the sheep is recorded by a fixed camera with wide-angle lens to capture the whole theater. Human, animals, technology, each is important here. And this is the diversity, the heterogeneity, but it's also the relation. You only get a reliable feel of the behavior of the sheep if the choreography of those relations is right, if they are ordered in a particular way. In this way of thinking, such is what is a practice, a somehow pattern sets of relations. And now the third point, practices are extended. The argument is that the relations that make up a successful practice aren't just here now and for the moment. They also reach out through time and space, depending on distant relations. We are seeing that there is a video camera in the experimental theater and the recording of the sheep reaction to the design experiment makes sense in an extended context that includes transport system, video laboratories, laboratory technique, and meticulous formal record keeping. The videos are then analyzed with a specific software and the results presented in the form of graph. So there is an extended relationality at work, and the patterns of those extended relations also need to be somehow ordered if a result is to be generated. A paper needs to be written, and the new measure needs to be validated because it's stuff there. This is a contested issue, and you need to be in a dominant, high-ranking journal if you want your science not to be labeled as a bad science. Practices, then, are relational patterns of ordering that reach beyond the scene. They are extensive. And then there is specificity. Here is the question, how large are practices? How much of the action that we are watching do they cover? This is a theoretical question, dressed up in a certain empirical language. There are reasons for choosing to spread the net wide and reasons for being more restrictive. I tend to work in specificity. Animals. To see what this might mean, well, let's retrace our steps. We've been looking at the vignette of animal science in practice, how an experiment on sheep emotion is carried out. In short, three versions of the sheep are being enacted. First, there is a productive sheep, the sheep as a body producing lambs. Second, there is a suffering individual, the sheep under stress or experiencing fear. And third, there is a learning sheep, the sheep as a subject that can learn how to cope with stress or fear and become a good mother, a brave sheep. And we could go on adding to this list. If we wanted to move beyond death, we could also talk of the sheep as a carcass, as Emma did it this morning. And that would extend the practice to distant places, and it would bring issues of material politics, of engagement with the liveliness of the afterlife of the sheep, the fleshy embodiment of the life of the sheep after life. Here in this experiment, the sheep is being done as a learning subject. And if we were to trace the lab practices beyond the weeks in which this experiment took place, we would find other sheep-human practices to do with the daily checks of their diet and blood tests. Just that we find practices to do with bloodlines, breeding, routine veterinary inspection, vaccination, market trading. But however much we extend it, the basic shape of the argument will stay the same. Each of these practices enact its own relationally emergent version of the sheep, and the relations between these practices are uncertain, complex, and probably only partially coherent. So what follows? In these ways of thinking, animals might be understood as the enacted effect of uncertain but patterned practices, and the uncertain choreographies in which these overlap. Everything I've said about the practices and their more or less awkward relations applies just as much to animals themselves. To be explicit, animals may be understood as the heterogeneous material and relational consequences of specific and pattern ordering practices that extend beyond local scenes to include more or less distant times and places. They are the expression of multiple logics that, for instance, include the daily work in the lab and the experimental farm that extend to the ecological, the nutritional, physiological, the cultural, and sheep certainly have their own culture. Read the paper by John Law and Marie Moore in 2008, for example, the geographical, the genetic, the veterinary, the economic, and the social. And since they are the expression of the intersection, more or less easy, of the endless different patterns of practice, they have been enacted in relations that are variously chronological, inclusive, dependent, held apart, and filled with tension and resistances. All this suggests that harmony is unlikely. It's almost impossible to talk about the signature, family, the signature of the sheep. In a performative word, the idea that practices might meld together for, within or around, the animal to generate the creature as a seamless whole makes little sense. We need instead to imagine the animals, indeed like people, are more or less decentric, that they are contingent colleges, as subjects, as bodies, and as elements in collectivities. For a performative theory of the animals tells us that any attachment to standard organic metaphors is likely to be misleading. To understand animals in their complexity, we will need to look beyond holes or signature. So what then, what is an animal? What is an animal that keeps going? A sheep that lives from day to day. Well, we might say that an animal is an animal because it moves between different practices more or less peacefully. Or to phrase it more carefully, we might say that an animal is an animal because the endless heterogeneous and extended practices that enact it as animals are woven together somehow peacefully. In this vision of the animal, the bounded body loses its privilege. Like everything else, this is better thought as an effect. Instead, it is the practices and their material extension, and especially the choreographies of those practices, to which I prefer to attend. How is that the different animal practices hold themselves together more or less well? How is that the problem of multiplicity is solved in practice and solved again? For however long this choreography of patterning is resolved day by day, the animal will indeed remain a less than completely decentered body and subject. It will hold itself together as a set of partially connected relations to form a less than a single and not entirely integrated whole. More than a set of fragments, it will continue to unfold as a fractional entity. But this cannot and does not happen forever. One day, the day when the choreography of practices fails and stops, then the animal starts to dissolve. And this is the end, it's a big transition. We call it death, and it happens all the time on farms and in slaughterhouses. And it comes to all of us. And this is basically all I wanted to say, but I want to conclude by touching on a moment on the methodological and political implication of such a vision. First, we simply do not know very much. People are implicated only in a small subset of animal practices. It's not that these are insignificant. Animal science research, genetics, farming, veterinary medicine, caring practices, market transaction, environmental management, all of these and more are consequential for animals. Indeed, many are matter of life and death. But even so, thought we know something about animal choreography, we don't know very much. So this is the first concluding point. Let us beware of those who claim to know animals in some larger way. When animal scientists or animal activists or animal farmers become immodest, then they need to be distrusted. Animals, as Donna Haraway tells us, are significantly others. They are elusive. No doubt, sweetgrass and the dying word that they picture is too romantic. It doesn't serve well to contrast the open spaces of Montana and the craft of the shepherd practices with the studies of scientists too sharply. But even so, a non-romantic apprehension of the mystery of animals on the one end and a commitment to a methodology, modesty on the other, this might be productive. For I'll finish. Argument is methodological but also political. Like animals, we too are embedded and enacted by practices. If animals are enacted in practices, then the character is not given in the order of things. Instead, they have been done multiply and endlessly in creative ways. What are the implications? Albeit with difficulties, our human-animal practices might be ordered differently. And the partial connection of ovine choreography are no doubt more or less well embedded. Even so, reality is not destiny, and it might be done in better ways, in terms of welfare, stretching ideas, expanding, growing ideas of welfare that go beyond the short narrative of cruelty-free, in terms of economics, in terms of animal science, and such is the challenge, and it implies the possibility of this partial recuperation, very much like Donna Haraway said, not as a dream or restoration or reconciliation, but the possibility of partial recuperation of finding something beautiful that might work.
Thank you.